From KCBW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. As hard as we try to be fair in clearing the innocent and punishing the guilty, there's plenty of room for error in the U.S. justice system. Eyewitnesses point out the wrong person in a lineup. Cops cut corners when gathering evidence. Prosecutors get overzealous. Defense lawyers get lazy. And even the accused give false confessions for any number of reasons. The sad result is an innocent person goes to prison, and it can happen to anyone. Today on the program, we're talking about making the case for innocence and the difficulty of creating a life after exoneration. Plus, finding global markets. We learn about the mission of the World Trade Center, Utah. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Faulty forensics, false confessions, eyewitness errors, shoddy police work, sloppy defense attorneys, all of these have led to thousands of wrongful convictions in the U.S. But over the past two decades, 2,000 convicted prisoners have been cleared and freed. Today on the program, we're talking about errors in our justice system and life after exoneration. Joining us this hour is Katie Monroe. She is the executive director of the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center, and she joins me in studio. Katie, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Also with us, Kate McLeod, a well-known singer-songwriter, fiddler, and guitar player who tours throughout the U.S. and has eight CDs under her belt. She is one of the driving forces behind a benefit concert happening this Sunday to benefit the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center. Kate McLeod joins me in studio. Kate, good morning.
Good morning.
And also with us by phone is William Dillon. He was released from a Florida prison after a 27-year incarceration for a murder he did not commit. He's subsequently founded the William Dillon Freedom Foundation, which helps exonerees transition back to normal life. And he's joining us by phone from his home in North Carolina. William Dillon, good morning.
Good morning. How y'all doing?
Great. Thank you so much for being with us. Dillon and four other exonerees will join on stage to perform in Jammin' for Justice, a benefit concert for the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center. And the concert will be held this Sunday, June 10th, at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. We'll give you more details on that as we go. But if you'd like to join us, if you have questions or comments about flaws in our justice system, about clearing the innocent, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. I actually want to start with a clip from one of William Dillon's songs. This is a song you wrote titled Black Robes and Lawyers. Let's take a listen, and then William Dillon, I'd love to talk about your experience.
My name is William Michael Dillon. I was arrested for murder on August 26, 1981, for a crime I didn't commit. I was released on November 18, 2008. Thank you for the keepers of justice. Took me away when I was a teen. Not really more than a boy, just lean. Sent to hell's prison to seal my fate. Only my will to survive. Let me reach that gate. Let me reach that gate. Let me reach that gate. I had to reach that gate. Black robes and lawyers, justice served, it will be done. Black robes and lawyers, Lady Justice lost this one. I was taken by the laws of justice.
Oh, yeah.
Cast away as a stone.
William Dillon, very powerful music and words. Take us back to the moment when you were accused of murder. This was back in 1981. Why were you targeted?
At the time, I was like a 20-year-old kid, and I was long-haired, and I was with my brother at a beach. The crime actually happened on a beach access area. It was a place where all the public came and parked and to go to the beach, and right to the right there was the place where the murder happened. It was a man that was beaten to death. And my brother pulled me in there as a passenger a couple of days after it had happened. And from there, they just started, they were still investigating. They walked up to the car and started questioning us. And next thing you know, they pulled me out of the car and took my picture and wanted me to come in for questioning. And from there, just spiraled down.
How did you react to that initial arrest?
Well, I honestly thought that it was just, they would eventually find out who actually did it. I didn't really take it. You know, I'm 20 years old, 21 years old. I really just took it with a grain of salt, believe it or not. It wasn't, it didn't seem that big at the time because I knew I hadn't committed the crime, and I figured they would eventually find out who had done it.
Hmm. I understand there were a number of big-time errors in your case. You know, one of the witnesses had a sexual relationship with the lead investigator during the investigation. One of the experts who testified was later shown to be a fraud. Another witness was partially blind. So what did it take to finally get people to take a second look at your case?
Actually, I filed the DNA testing myself from prison. Nobody was looking at my case at that point. When I filed the DNA testing, the judge looked at it and granted me a hearing for DNA testing, and that's when they took me to the county jail, and the news media came in and asked me. I'd been in prison for like 26 years at that point. And they came in and asked me why I was there, and I did an interview telling them my story and my case, and I laid it all out to them. And next thing you know, the Innocent Project of Florida got on top of it and came down and represented me in my DNA motion.
I understand that roughly 230 people have been exonerated as a result of DNA test results. You are the one who served the longest time of any of them, over 27 years in prison. Did you ever think you'd get out, that you'd eventually be cleared of the murder charge?
Well, for many years, I thought for sure I was going to get free, that they were going to eventually find. I still had that young boy syndrome, thinking that they were going to eventually find out who did it, and I was going to be freed, and it was going to be this big wild bash. And, you know, for many years, and then as the years went by, the hope slowly faded. You know, the whole dreams of all that faded until our last-ditch effort, that somebody just happened to come towards me and ask me if I'd ever had a DNA test, and I told them no, and then they told me how to do it, and I filed it, and miracles happen every day.
Hmm. Speaking with William Dillon, he was released from a Florida prison after a 27-year incarceration for a murder he didn't commit. He's also the founder of the William Dillon Freedom Foundation, and he's going to be performing in Salt Lake City with four other exonerees on stage for a benefit concert for the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center. We'll give you details on that as we go. 801-355-TALK is our number if you'd like to join us. 801-355-8255. Katie Monroe from the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center. Bill's story, certainly poignant. Unfortunately, a storyline that you've heard before.
Yes, many times.
And you have some personal experience to back this up. Tell us about your story and why you got involved in Innocence Projects.
I do. I have both a personal experience and a long professional experience in this work. My mother is an exoneree from Virginia. She was wrongly convicted of murder for the suicide death of her then boyfriend, and she was exonerated in 2003. And I actually had an interest in this work even before that. It was one of the way that the criminal justice system operates and how law enforcement officials handle themselves within that has always been an interest of mine. And it was like my professional interests and my personal life collided. And I've been now working in the innocence field for a very long time.
Hmm. A recent study shows that 2,000 convictions have been overturned and the accused set free over the past 20 years. That's just a handful of the convictions that are out there. But it does show that there are flaws in the system. And this recent study found that the most common factor leading to false convictions was false accusations. What do you make of that?
You mean eyewitness identification,
sure.
Mistaken eyewitness mm-hmm. identification. Well, that is the number one cause of wrongful convictions. It was involved in 75% of all of the DNA exonerations. And really the reason for that, and frankly the reason for all of the mistakes that happen in our system, are it's human error. Our mind doesn't operate like a tape recorder. It doesn't recall and repeat things like a tape recorder. And about 30 years of social science research has demonstrated that most of us, when being asked to recall something we've seen, we tend to there's a lot of subjective processing as part of that, and we make mistakes. And so, sadly, more often than not, eyewitnesses are mistaken. Even crime victims who experience the crime directly make mistakes more often than not.
So why do the courts continue to put so much faith in personal testimony? Why do the jurors believe people when they get on the stand and give their, you know, undoubted account of what happened?
Well, it's very powerful testimony, obviously, and we want to believe that what we're testifying to is what we actually saw. And of course, if it's someone who experienced the crime, him or herself, then it's people are hard-pressed to disbelieve them. I think more and more people are understanding that eyewitness identification is fallible, that it's not as reliable as we'd like to hope, and that we're working more and more with police organizations to improve the way eyewitnesses are handled so that that evidence can be presented in court more reliably. And courts are beginning to put mechanisms in place that that give the best eyewitness identification evidence to the jurors as possible.
In William Dillon's case, the lead investigator was in a relationship with one of the witnesses. So there are gaps in the police part of this whole conviction equation too. How common is that in the cases that you handle at Rocky Mountain Innocence Center?
Well, we don't necessarily see all the time instances of conflicts of interest or other misconduct, if you will. Usually it's negligence. What we see in every single case is something that we call police tunnel vision, which involves, which usually manifests itself in police investigators jumping to conclusions too quickly and then following a course of investigation that tends to support that predetermined hunch or decision, and then ignoring evidence that conflicts with it. And we see that in every single case. And that's usually the thing that starts the wrongful accusation rolling, and then it all kind of falls in line after that. There's probably not enough oversight of police conduct in investigations, and frankly, there's always too few resources within the police agencies and too little training.
William Dillon, at what point in your trial did you start to see some of the flaws that were coming, you know, crashing down around you and were going to eventually convict you? I mean, at what point did it sort of dawn on you that this is real and it's not going away?
Well, I believe the point for me that I felt it was crashing was right when they said that they found me guilty as a jury. But I heard much of the testimony that was all false testimony, and a lot of my friends saying I was wearing a shirt that the killer had worn. And this is all part of the police getting people to say what they need them to say. I don't believe in my case that mine was a mistake. I believe that they intentionally in their mind sought me out and were able to tell people that I committed a crime and make them believe it, and it worked for them. I think that right at that point of my conviction in my trial was the point where I firmly believed that it was a downhill battle, but I still believed that they were going to figure out who actually committed the crime.
Mm. We're speaking with William Dillon. He was released from a Florida prison after a 27-year wrongful conviction. He is the founder of the William Dillon Freedom Foundation. He's also an accomplished musician, and he and four other exonerees will be performing in Salt Lake City as part of a benefit concert for the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center that's being held this Sunday, June 10th, 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. If you'd like to join us, we're talking about wrongful convictions, about flaws in our justice system. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Today on the program, we're talking about what happens when you're convicted of a crime, but you didn't do it. Over the past 20 years, 2,000 people found themselves in this situation and were eventually freed. Joining us on the program this morning is one of them, Bill Dillon. He served over 27 years of hard time in Florida before being exonerated. He's one of five exonerated musicians who will be playing in a concert to benefit the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center this coming Sunday. We'll give you details on that in a bit. Also with us in studio is Katie Monroe, the executive director of the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center, and Kate McLeod, a well-known singer-songwriter and the driving force behind this benefit concert. Kate, what gave you the idea of gathering former former convicted felons, people who did not commit a crime, and gathering them on stage to share their experience through music?
Well, I've known Katie for quite a while, and I'd heard her talk about her innocence conferences and the musicians that she heard there or met there, and we talked about this for a couple of years before we did anything structurally. And we decided at one point that, we'd really like to get these people together and have them experience music together. Music is so important to people. And then when you have a common thing that drives your life together, then it can be even more amazing. And so I kept thinking, wow, we should get these musicians in one place and have them play music together, and it sounds like a great thing to do. And, you know, as a musician, I myself know how that feels when you play with people that you have a common background with. And so we decided to do it about a year and a half ago or so at a conference, their first concert, and some of them had not met each other before. And so several months before the conference, I had been in touch with as many as we could find at the time, musicians that had been exonerated. And some of them had been aspiring musicians before they were imprisoned, and some of them had learned while they were, spent a lot of time on instruments while they're in prison. And the first time we organized anything, it was quite an amazing thing. I had not even met most of them before that weekend, and all I did was I just facilitate. You know, I understand sort of what musicians need, and I felt like the conference needed someone who knows what the musicians are going to need. You know, I coordinated rehearsal space, and I just coordinate things for this, and I don't play, and this is the only thing I never play anything in as a performing musician, but it's really fun for me to get these musicians together, and it's an incredibly powerful experience. I went home after the first concert. I went home and said to my friends, we ought to pack up all of our instruments and give up. You ought to hear these guys I just heard over the weekend. So I hope that, I hope to work with them some more with these situations. I really enjoy it.
William Dillon, when did music start to enter your life? Was this prior to your wrongful conviction, or did you find music within the confines of the prison?
I've been a singer basically all my life, just not a professional singer or anything, just singing songs and copy tunes and stuff like that. It really took a hold for me in 1985 in Florida State Prison, where I wrote that song that you just heard, Black Robes and Lawyers, on toilet paper. And I did that basically not as a songwriter, but as a poet, I guess you could say, in a sense, is I didn't think that at that point anybody was going to hear my songs. But through my time in prison, I was actually put in different prisons that had of the few that they did have, some that had instruments and accessibility to it. So I figured that I'd always wanted to do it, to learn how to play the guitars and sing with my voice. So I figured that I'd take that shot. So that's how it basically worked for me, is I started writing songs before I ever learned how to play anything or anything like that.
I want to play another clip from your CD, Black Robes and Lawyers. This is a track called Passing Time. Anything you want to say about it before we listen, William Dillon?
It's basically passing time is just what it says. That's exactly what it is. It's a person in prison that's dreaming about where they want to be and what they need to do and where they would be in their life.
Okay, let's take a listen. This is William Dillon and Passing Time.
I've been thinking of cities, places I've never been. Remedy for my soul that lies within. Portland in the springtime, down to Georgia when it rains. And when the snow falls, it's back to FLA. I sit here for hours, traveling in my mind, adventures in my head, just passing time. Passing time, passing time. I sit here with my dreams, passing time. Doesn't matter.
William Dillon, he's performing Passing Time, one of the musicians who will be performing in a benefit concert for the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center this Sunday night, June 10th, at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. William, I'm curious what it feels like to be on stage with musicians, you know, people who have gone through an experience very similar to yours. What is that like?
It's powerful. It's such a great feeling, in the sense that the guys on stage, Ray, Tuan, Eddie, and Darby, we all get this sort of power that says that we were cheated out of this in our youth, and now we want to let people know exactly where we're coming from, that we were products that could be something, and they took that away from us. And so now we're going to take this time, whatever time we have left, and we're going to show the world through music exactly who we are and what we're all about.
Now, you have been performing with fellow exonerees on a number of occasions, but this is your first public performance coming up in Salt Lake. How different do you think that's going to be from your prior concerts?
I don't think for us it'll be any different. We do everything with that same sense of methodic. We're basically there to do it. We know what we're doing. And for us, I think it'll be even more energizing, because it is those people that we're trying to reach anyway. I mean, when you get a whole bunch of the Innocent Project people together, like 700 or so, and you get them in there and everybody's on the same page, it's the ones that don't know what's really going on that need to come in and hear what's really happening. Those are the ones that we're trying to get to.
William Dillon performing this Sunday night with four others on stage. Jammin' for Justice is what it's called, a benefit concert for the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center. Kate McLeod, we've heard the word powerful over and over. I mean, what, as an audience member, you're not an exoneree yourself, but I mean, what makes it so powerful for you?
Well, there's a lot more to music than the notes that you hear. And When these musicians perform together, there's an X factor or an added dimension to what's going on musically, and I find that it's a beautiful thing. And so I'd really like for people to come and hear this. It's very special.
Mm-hmm. We'll have more information on our website, kcpw.org. But if you'd like to join us, if you have questions or comments about wrongful convictions, about life after exoneration, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Katie Monroe with the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center is with us as well. Katie, William Dillon was eventually exonerated because of DNA testing, about, you know, new results. And how is technology sort of changing the way people prove their innocence in court?
Well, DNA has been the number one factor in changing the way people think about wrongful convictions. And frankly, I'm not sure that people thought anything about wrongful convictions prior to 1989, when there was the first DNA exoneration. Since then, there's actually been 292 DNA exonerations. And then, as we know from the new National Registry of Exonerations, at least another, 600 non-DNA exonerations. And like you mentioned, that's just the tip of the iceberg, because finding, identifying who in prison is actually innocent and then coming up with the evidence that would give a court to would cause a court to give it a second look is extremely difficult. And so we're probably reaching, just 1 or 2% of all of the people who are wrongly convicted. But DNA, the DNA evidence has the power to scientifically and objectively and without any subjective interpretation demonstrate what actually happened at a crime. And the benefit of that is not only does it identify and prove the innocence of people in prison wrongly, but it also helps us identify who actually committed the crime, which then brings that true justice and true finality to the crime victim. In about just under 50% of all of the DNA exonerations, that evidence that has freed the innocent has actually identified the perpetrator, who, of course, was unapprehended at the time and went on to commit additional crimes. And one of the things we like to talk about a lot is how this work that we do doesn't just benefit innocent people in prison and their friends and families. It benefits crime victims, law enforcement officials, tax-paying citizens, law enforcement, everyone. I mean, it's a true public service. And in that sense, I want to invite people not only to come out and hear music on Sunday night, which is, of course, the purpose of this event, but also to understand more about what we do and to identify with what we do and hopefully begin to support us more fully in the community.
How do you decide? I'm sure you get appeals for help all the time. How do you kind of sift through those? How do you decide which cases warrant your attention and which may just be calls for help, but the evidence isn't there?
Well, that's exactly how it should be put. We get about 200 requests for help across three states. We cover Nevada, Utah, and Wyoming. Every year we get about 200 requests for help. Most of those we have to reject immediately, either because they don't meet our basic criteria, meaning they're not in the place of their case where we can actually begin to look at it, or they're not making a full claim of innocence. About 50% of those go through a screening process, a very strict screening process, where we try to identify, one, is it a compelling and credible claim of factual innocence? And two, is the evidence there that could prove that? And that is the most difficult piece. We end up looking at about 10 or 15 cases every year out of those 200 requests of help we get. And we can probably only help, maybe 2, 3, 5 of those individuals, not because they're not innocent, but because what needs to be there to prove their innocence, we're not going to be able to find. And part of it is the evidence may not be there, but part of it is there's this requirement that the evidence be new. If a jury or a judge heard the evidence of innocence at the time of trial or could have heard it and it just wasn't developed or presented, then an innocent person in prison can't pursue that as proof of innocence 15, 20, 25 years after the fact. So not only do we have to find proof of innocence, it has to be new evidence of innocence, and that's extremely difficult. So most innocent people in prison will never be able to prove their innocence and win their rightful freedom.
That's a sobering thought. Speaking with Katie Monroe, the executive director of the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center. Also in studio, Kate McLeod, a well-known singer-songwriter and organizer of this weekend's benefit concert, Jammin' for Justice, being held at the Rose Wagner. And by phone, William Dillon, one of the exonerees who will be performing on Sunday. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. And let's go to the phones. Jeff is joining us from Salt Lake City. Jeff, hello.
Hello. This gentleman is the number one reason why proof why we should never execute, because it's too easy to railroad and execute the innocent.
Jeff, good point. Thanks very much for the call. William Dillon, your thoughts on that, on capital punishment, and what your experience has taught you on that regard. William, are you there?
I am here.
What do you think about Jeff's take on capital punishment? He says you're living proof of why we shouldn't execute.
I mean, it is a matter of fact that there's at least 2,000 people the reason why we shouldn't execute. I'm dead set against the death row. I'm dead set against any kind of killing people for the lawful justice of America, supposedly. And the facts are all there in black and white, and they're walking around now free right now. You know, they didn't seek the death penalty against me because that Donna Parrish was having sex with the chief investigator. That was a part of a plea deal that my lawyer made to keep it secret from my trial in order not for them not to seek the death penalty. And I always tell people that, that on paper, if they would have given me the death penalty, that you wouldn't be talking to me today.
Mm. Kate McClellan.
Yes, about that, Darby Tillis, who's going to be performing this Sunday, was on death row himself. And he actually worked for years to clear himself before many people were even working in this field of innocence. He's a very interesting man. He's a minister, and he's an incredible blues musician. And he has a very long and a detailed story about how he managed to free himself from death row, the first one to free himself from death row in Illinois.
Katie Monroe, I mean, it is, it does put things in stark perspective when you think, you know, somebody's life is in the balance depending on all sorts of just little, you know, factual errors, things that could have gone wrong in eyewitness accounts or, you know, wrong place at the wrong time kind of thing. It's sobering.
It is, and it's scary, right? I mean, we know it's a human system, and so it can't be denied that the system makes mistakes. And even at a 1% error rate, we have 2.2 million people in prison in the United States. A 1% error rate would suggest, you know, tens of thousands of people in prison mistakenly. But we've got better numbers than that now. One of the other things that DNA evidence has done is enable us to identify those causes of wrongful convictions, the things that we see in cases over and over, like police tunnel vision and mistaken eyewitness identification. And the most conservative and credible demonstrated error rate that we have is 3 to 6%, and that is only in violent felonies, rapes and murders. Nobody's counting yet in a nonviolent felonies or lesser offenses. In Virginia, where I was living before I came here, we had so many exonerations that the governor ordered an audit of our crime lab, and we discovered in Virginia that we had a 9% error rate in everything coming out of the crime lab.
9%.
And I would, so I would, I if I, you know, given the amount of work that I've done in this field, I would say that a 10% error rate is not up in the night. I mean, that's probably realistic for a human system where there's room for error at every single stage. I mean, we're humans. It's a fallible system. And with respect to the death penalty, that probably is the number one reason, right, that people should oppose the death penalty is the fact that the system can make mistakes. And a number of exonerees have been freed from death row. And it certainly is reason to pause and think.
Jeff, thanks very much for the call. We've only got a short time left, but one of the most high-profile wrongful conviction cases locally has been the Deborah Brown case. She, of course, was convicted of the 1993 murder of her employer. She was found factually innocent and released just over a year ago, last May. What does factually innocent mean?
So factually innocent means that for the purposes of our screening, for example, that means you weren't involved in the crime in any way. Not that you couldn't be there. You have no knowledge of it. You're factually innocent. There are different statutes in different states. Most states now have a post-conviction DNA testing statute where the DNA evidence has to prove that you weren't the person who left the biological evidence at the crime scene. In a case like Deb's, factual innocence it doesn't mean anything different, but it's proven differently. So in her case, for example, what we were able to demonstrate was that the victim died at a time when she could not have killed him. And interestingly, what we see in a lot of these cases is that there was a determination of death originally made, but then after the police attached to a particular suspect, that time of death was shifted to fit the time frame that the suspect could have committed the crime. And what we learned in Deb's case is that the victim was alive long after the time that the state believed that he had been killed, and that he was killed at a time when Deb could not have killed him. And that's the kind of factual innocence. I mean, it can be different things. There have been exonerations, non-DNA exonerations, when eyewitnesses have been discovered to have been mistaken. There have been, and that was the only or the main evidence of guilt, right? Or when the actual perpetrator has come forward and eventually confessed. We find that there's a lot of resistance in non-DNA cases to the issue of innocence, but frankly, there's still resistance in DNA cases. 9 out of 10 DNA cases, we still find government officials saying, well, fine, it's not his or her biological evidence that was left at the scene, but we still think that they were probably involved. We still think that they're guilty. And that's probably the most important cultural shift that needs to happen, which is for government officials to really embrace that that it's their responsibility to make sure that the right person is in prison and that the system does make mistakes. And so we need that open-mindedness and that support in this post-conviction setting as well.
Deborah Brown's case, of course, has been appealed to the Utah Supreme Court. Any sense of when a decision will be made on that?
No, there's still briefs that are being filed, and an oral argument will need to happen. We imagine that will happen sometime in the fall. But in the meantime, Deb and her family are still strong and doing well. Deb is innocent, and she knows that, and most of the community knows that, and they're supportive of her, so they're doing well. And she will be available at our event on Sunday as well, where Squatters Pubs and Brew are throwing a party for us in advance of the concert, and Deb will be available there to tell her story and meet her supporters as well.
Our time is very short, unfortunately, but William Dillon, you after you were exonerated, you set up the William Dillon Freedom Foundation to help people who are in your situation, people who have been cleared of crimes, return to a normal life. I'm wondering, what are some of the difficulties that you faced in transitioning from prison life to normal life?
Well, initially, I was dropped like a hot potato. They just opened up, and here you go. I mean, even a person on parole gets $100. They didn't give me absolutely anything, but just say, okay, here you go. You're free now. And it pretty much left me completely destitute. You know, if I didn't have some family or friends or anything, then I can imagine what life would have been like. And that's really what I thought they wanted. You know, they wanted you to be without nothing and create some sort of a situation for you so in the destitution. I mean, the Freedom Foundation is just that. It creates a place that if you need a car, if you still have family and your kids need something, that's what it's really all about. I mean, for me, it was family and friends. Without them, I wouldn't have had nothing.
What's your life been like since your release?
Well, since my release, I've been going to the Barry Scheck Innocent Project conferences, and my life has been great. I've been moving on. I've been making music. I put out a CD last year, September 27th. It's for sale on Amazon.com. And Grammy Award-winning producer Jim Tullio, awesome cat. I guess you can see from the production of the songs, it's amazing on a big level. It's been fantastic for me. I mean, life has really moved on. Of course, you know, the governor apologized to me on March 1st of this year, which was a great thing in front of the television cameras. And a lot of people say that an apology, what's an apology after 27 years, but when a man as the head of the state apologizes to you for some things that people did a long time ago, it's quite a big deal.
William Dillon, he was exonerated after 27 years for a murder he didn't commit. He and four others will be performing on stage in the benefit concert Jammin' for Justice for the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center. And William Dillon, thanks very much for your time today. I appreciate it.
I appreciate being there.
Also,
I can't wait for this weekend.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing from you on stage. Katie Monroe is Executive Director of the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you, and I hope everybody will come out and support us. We're a 501c3 organization, and we depend entirely on private donations, so please come out. You can learn more at our website, which is rminnocence.org. Thank you.
Thank you. And Kate McLeod, a singer-songwriter and organizer of this week's event. And Kate, thanks for your time as well.
Thank you.
Again, the benefit concert for the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center called Jammin' for Justice will be held this Sunday, June 10th at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. And again, we'll have links on our website, kcpw.org. Coming up next, we're going to turn to Utah and the global marketplace. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City.
Most of my life in prison. chasing a dream called justice.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. It used to be called Eagle Gate Tower, but the building at 60 South Temple has been renamed the World Trade Center at City Creek. What exactly is the World Trade Center Utah? Today on the program, we're going to hear more about the nonprofit and about the potential for Utah companies working in a global marketplace. And joining me in the studio now is Lou Kramer. He is the founding president and CEO of World Trade Center Utah. Lou, good morning. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Jennifer. Delighted to be here.
If you've got questions about why Utah has a World Trade Center and what the potential is for Utah companies, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Lou, what exactly do you do? Explain the mission, the goals of the World Trade Center Utah.
Our main goal, Jennifer, is to take Utah companies into the international marketplace successfully and profitably. We are a nonprofit, and our job is to take the 3,500 companies that are already exporting in Utah and expand that number. In short, we are to educate, motivate, and facilitate international trade for our great state.
I understand you've been in business since 2006 and that you said 3,500 Utah businesses are already out in that global marketplace. Right. Over 1,000 have been involved in seminars and events that you have sponsored. What are the tangible results that you've seen since 2006? How has this global market grown?
For Utah, it's been an exciting story. Since 2006, we have tripled exports from this state. In fact, Utah is leading the nation in international export growth for the last 5 years. President Obama has a goal, as does Governor Herbert, to double exports in the next 5 years because of the job creation that will manifest. Utah's already done that over the last 5 years, and hence we've had a lot of visitors from around the world come here and said, what's your secret? Why is this working? And that's the unprecedented partnerships that Governor Herbert is urging us to have with GOED, the Governor's Office of Economic Development, the Chambers of Commerce, the Small Business Administration, and others.
There was a letter to the editor in the Salt Lake Tribune over the weekend that asked why call it the World Trade Center. In that name, it was somehow disrespectful to, you know, the horrors that happened on 9/11. So why use the name World Trade Center, do you think?
Well, we're one of 331 World Trade Centers around the world, so this is nothing new. Most major cities in the world have a World Trade Center. The largest building in Beijing is the World Trade Center Beijing, or in Abu Dhabi, or in Rio de Janeiro. And our hope is that we are showing that the terrorists didn't win. We're out there to show that prosperity comes and peace comes through trade. And this enhanced trade has had that happen. And I'm as sympathetic and as anyone to that. I was in New York on that horrible day. I was at the World Trade Center. I saw this kind of tragedy take place. And many of us sitting there said, this will not stand. And as you know, New Yorkers have rebuilt the World Trade Center in process of doing that. And there are, as I say, hundreds of World Trade Centers around the world. And given our incredible export growth here in the Utah, it certainly justifies people knowing Utah is open for international business.
Speaking with Lou Kramer, he's the founding president and CEO of the World Trade Center Utah. And if you'd like to join us, if you have questions or comments about the global marketplace and Utah companies trying to horn in on the global marketplace, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. You mentioned 3,500 Utah businesses are out there. What kinds of goods and services are Utah companies exporting?
It's an exciting range and diversity of products. Number one, for the last 100 years, maybe for the next 100, has been primary metals. So we've had gold, copper, molybdenum, those kinds of things. But the number two area of export growth has been in the high-tech products, medical devices, IT, computer chips. IM Flash, for example, down at Thanksgiving Point. Some months it ships a couple $100 million worth of chips around the world. In fact, our commodity exports last year almost topped $19 billion. And for a small state of 3 million people without a seaport, that's phenomenal per capita involvement in international trade. And that directly translates into jobs, higher paying, longer lasting, higher skilled jobs in the state of Utah. The Department of Commerce estimates over 100,000 jobs are directly related to exports in the state.
Where in the world are Utah products going? I mean, are there certain markets that work well and others that are kind of falling flat?
Great question. And it varies, of course, depending on the economic uncertainties of this global economy we're in. 95% of the world's customers are outside of the United States. Utahns seem to find Europe still is the number one destination for lots of reasons. But number two is Greater China. So we've been under Governor Huntsman's leadership, under Governor Herbert's very strong international trade warriorship. We have really expanded our work in Asia. In fact, we're doing a trade mission next week to Korea and Japan, led by the Governor's Office of Economic Development. We'll be doing one into Indonesia in September. So we're taking advantage of the fact, as Goldman Sachs recently said, in the next decade, 60% of the world's economic growth is going to be outside of North America, Japan, and Europe. So that's where the real opportunities are in the emerging markets. And Utah's got some wonderful links in that marketplace.
You mentioned Utah's inroads into Europe and into China. But with all, you know, all the economic crisis in Europe, we hear about slow growth in China, lots of turmoil in the Middle East right now. Is now really a good time for Utah businesses to start exploring beyond the borders? I mean, is it a good time? Is there ever a good time?
It's always a good time to go international, given the fact, as we said, 95% of the growth, the customers are outside there. We see that people want to trade, and if you're doing business together, you're much less likely to start a war because you've got commercial and economic ties that bind each other. And even in the marketplace, Utah products, U.S. products are in demand. Therefore, exports continue to be an area of growth. And we are here to help, together with our partners at the U.S. Commercial Service, the Governor's Office of Economic Development, and our other unprecedented partners here in the state to give you information about where it makes sense to sell your product. And so we'd really welcome you stopping by our new offices at the World Trade Center at City Creek to meet our partners.
You mentioned that you are in the same building as USTAR, the Governor's Office of Economic Development, the Office of Energy Development. Why concentrate all of these groups in one place? And how is what World Trade Center Utah do? How is that distinguished between these other groups that seem to be doing something very similar?
It's a great question. And, you know, most customers, clients don't care who's helping them. They just want an answer. And if they come to the World Trade Center and ask me a question about energy development, I'd say, Samantha Julian is the state's expert on it. She's right down the hall. Let's go meet Samantha. Same with the Governor's Office of Economic Development. We co-host seminars. In fact, on Thursday, we're having a special seminar on doing business in Saudi Arabia. We had one last week with doing business in the Middle East. We have all kinds of opportunities, and using these various partners, we're able to get the word out. USTAR, in fact, is an example. If it's technology today, it's international. And as you know, the University of Utah leads the nation in commercialization of products. Where are those being sold? Many, many of them have an international strategy because that's where the sale opportunities are. And with the internet, you know, you are in the international marketplace, whether you want it or not. We're also close, being downtown, close to the banking centers, to the educational institutions and our other partners that are critical to make international trade work.
So you said that Utah companies are high in exporting metals, in high-tech products. What sort of growth potential do you see for Utah companies over the next 5 years? I mean, are there other sectors besides these kind of powerhouse metals,
sure,
high-techs? What else is out there, and what is the potential?
Interestingly enough, agriculture continues to be a mainstay of what we're doing. We are shipping alfalfa to Saudi Arabia by aircraft. We don't get credit for the products that go to Utah and then are shipped out of a port in California or Washington State. But we can put many of these agricultural products on airplanes out of our great partners at Delta and others here, of course, at the Salt Lake Airport hub, and take advantage of that. We're also doing very well in transportation equipment. We have high-tech products in that area, parts of the Boeing 787 Dreamliner, for example, made right here in Utah. We have a continued growth in the nutraceutical areas. We have companies that are shipping agricultural products literally so many places that they don't want other people to know about it because their competitors are going to find out and take advantage of those marketplaces as well. Another advantage, of course, we have is we speak 130 languages or so in this state. Some have said we have more per capita speakers of a second language than anybody in the country. And that's a huge advantage when you're doing cultural interaction, trying to shake hands, share a business card with a business executive around the world if you can speak his or her language. And we've got that capacity in the state.
Mm. Just about a minute left. But what's the first step for a Utah business that's, thinking about expanding beyond the nation's borders. What kind of advice would you have for people who are eyeing the international market?
First, great question. First of all, I'd make sure that they feel comfortable with their own business plan, that it's going to work in domestic setting. But they should give us a call or go on our website, WTCUT.com, WTCUT.com. And we are steps away from the Governor's Office of Economic Development, steps away from the USTAR folks. And somewhere in between there, we'll give you answers about opportunities that are overseas for you, working with our partners all over the planet.
Lou Kramer, he is the founding president and CEO of World Trade Center Utah, finding its new home at the City Creek Center. And Lou, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Jennifer, very much.
City Views is a production of KCPW News in Salt Lake City. Thanks to Lauren Hendrickson. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. Coming up tomorrow, 20 years of fresh local food will mark the anniversary with the Downtown Farmers Market. So join us for that tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce.